Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In January 2017, just days before he was sworn in as President of the United States, Donald Trump had this memorable exchange with CNN reporter Jim Acosta.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization,
can
you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance
to
ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can you state, Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically?
She's asking a question.
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically?
The president also famously announced the previous October that he had invented fake news. Now the phenomenon has been studied. Robinson Meyer of The Atlantic recently wrote about the research. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I just played that cut to get us in the mood to talk about something that doesn't really have as much to do with the president as maybe he would like. You wrote about a first-of-its-kind study by MIT researchers who published their findings in Science in early March. How did they define fake news?
Yeah, so they were looking at anything, kind of any contested rumor, any factual claim that might be true or might not be true, that was then fact-checked by one of the major fact-checking organizations, so Snopes or PolitiFact, and then they looked at, I think, five others, including some that specialize in urban legends. And then they looked at kind of appearances of those myths or those rumors, some of which are true, some of which aren't true, on Twitter. And the cool thing is that because they had this large database of, from fact-checking organizations and because of the natural language processing algorithms they use, they were able to look at, more than 100,000 kind of different rumors or contested rumors, all of which were discussed on Twitter during kind of its full run, its full 11-year history going back to 2007.
And just to be clear, we're not talking about stories that had somebody's the wrong age for somebody or misspelled their name, or this is stuff that was purposefully inaccurate or untrue and put out there.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So one of the researchers told me, there's a lot of menagerie animals in the false information. There's a lot of different animals in the false information menagerie.
Mm-hmm.
Something they were not looking at exactly are stories that had stories and legitimate news organizations that had something inaccurate, that got something wrong and then were later corrected. But they were looking at hoaxes, unsupported rumors, and then what they call fake news, which is kind of the original use of the term, which it would be, something that looks like it's news, something that looks like it's journalistic in content, and is not actually accurate in any way, nor is it interested in being accurate in any way.
The study found that fake news travels faster than real news. How much faster?
A lot faster. I believe it's 6 times faster. And in fact, the authors found that on Twitter, kind of falsehoods of any type, not just fake news, travel farther into the network. They travel much faster. They reach more people, and they appear much more kind of likely to get retweeted than accurate information. So it's not just that fake news like moves faster, it's that falsehoods seem to be like a much stickier, much better form of information. Like they perform much better because they are falsehoods than the truth does on Twitter.
Did MIT study whether or not the people who were passing these things along knew that they were fake?
They did not. They did look at who they did not fully look at this at that, but they did provide examples, and one of the ways that they were able to kind of measure the travel of falsehoods through the ecosystem is by looking at how many people retweeted individual tweets.
Mm-hmm.
So often you have just a few tweets that may drive a huge falsehood through the network, and it's not because people are seeing it and then independently tweeting about it. It's because people are seeing it and then retweeting it. And so, when you look at like that, you see that, you know, I think the longest retweet chain, so that's someone retweeting a story that someone else has retweeted, basically, mm-hmm. Like a chain of a link of retweets through the network, was 19. So you were able to kind of rank up a 19 link long retweet chain with falsehoods, and the longest ever accurate falsehood retweet chain was just 10 retweets long. So falsehoods seem to like get much, much further into the network than true stories do.
We're talking about fake news and how it travels and how it has traveled in the era of Twitter. My guest is Robinson Meyer. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he wrote about a new study put out by MIT in early March. If you have a question or comment, we're going to talk the whole hour about this, but we only have Robinson for the segment. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Did it matter, Robinson, or was it significant who was doing the tweeting? Did they break down by political party or gender or anything like that?
Great question. You know, we don't have demographic information on who was doing the tweeting like that on a partisan basis or on a, you know, demographic, racial, or gender basis. What they did find, and which I think is quite concerning, is that it's not, I think there is a misconception that people retweet, that false news travels farther because, you know, the people spreading false news maybe have more followers, they are more likely to be verified, or they're more popular, or they just send more tweets, so they have more, you know, things out there in the world. Mm-hmm. The researchers found that wasn't true. In fact, the people with the most followers, people who are most likely to verify, people who use Twitter the most, all mostly, you know, spread accurate information. They were far more likely to spread accurate information. And accounts that don't use Twitter that often, that aren't verified, that were the most likely to spread false information. And yet, despite all the kind of things working against those accounts, their few number of followers, the fact they weren't verified, the falsehood still traveled further. So in some ways, it seemed like all the benefits of the network were kind of accruing to users who didn't have that many followers, or mm-hmm. they still, sorry, there's brief point of the news.
Robinson, we're losing you. Robinson, we're going to call you back. We're losing
okay,
you right
I'm,
now. I just
me?
Want... yeah, are you there?
Okay, sorry. Okay. Yeah, sorry. There was a noisy moment in the newsroom.
Okay.
Just to kind of finish what I was saying, uh-huh. All the benefits of the network seem to help people who spread real news. But when you look at, and yet despite that, despite the fact that people who spread real news have more followers, mm-hmm. Fake news travels faster anyway. So it's, you know, falsehood kind of performs better on its own merits, if that makes sense.
How do they know that they weren't just bots, Twitter bots, fake news accounts, fake Twitter accounts?
Yeah, so the study looked at bots and was able to compare, was able to use a number of different contemporary techniques drawn from across MIT to kind of identify Twitter bots versus actual humans using Twitter. And what they found was that Twitter bots do spread falsehoods and they do spread fake news, but they actually spread falsehoods and fake news as much as they spread real news. So they're just amplifying everything. If you look at human users, it's the human users who seem to spread false news a lot more than they do accurate news. And so there are like bots spreading false news. But it seems to mostly be human users who are really spreading the falsehoods.
And fake political news spread especially quickly, faster than anything.
That's exactly right. And so they found that false news and falsehoods of all types kind of spread in all categories of information. So you mm-hmm. get it about weather, you get it about natural disasters and entertainment and business and technology. But it is political news that does the best, yeah.
Do they know why?
I don't. They do not you're not hazard why. I think what we know from other, you know, I report on technology and I also report on climate change. Mm-hmm. And what I would say I've learned from climate change reporting is that partisan polarization is a very strong thing. Mm-hmm. And people tend to want to, I think, when Americans think about how the kind of media ecosystem works, when a lot of Americans do, they kind of imagine that their fellow Americans are learning things because they see them on the news and they see them. That's kind of the full menu from which they choose information. But at this point, it's such a polarized country that we want to find information that supports what their team says they should believe. And so people will really go out and look for information that lets them kind of continue to be on the right team and lets them continue to believe the right things. And I think that I would estimate at least that's a reason why political news that's false seems to do so much better than any other kind of news that's false.
What are the researchers' theories about why true stories are shared less frequently?
You know, the researchers don't really have theories. This was mostly an observation. A point I would make generally is that in some ways this is a concerning finding because we imagine, we kind of analogize social media, Twitter and Facebook to being more like the newspaper.
I don't, but go ahead.
Well, I think journalists tend to treat it like a place where there's accurate information. I think even in culture, right, like been for several years a sense that checking in on social media is, you know, has picked up some of the kind of daily habitual notion like checking in on the news.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not going to endorse that behavior, but I think that's a real thing in culture.
Okay.
The problem here is that these are big marketplaces, and they're big marketplaces for stories. And if I had to hazard a guess at what's happening here, maybe fiction just always does better than nonfiction. I mean, in nonfiction, there's a ton of constraints, right? Like you have to be accurate. That's mostly the big one. While falsehoods and fake stories and rumors and hoaxes can really be engineered in such a way as to travel as far as possible because they're not constrained by the truth at all. And so if I had to kind of hazard why the one reason this might be happening, it might just be because falsehoods kind of always make for a better story. That's why we have movies and novels and everything else. It's just that in this case, they spread on a platform and in such a way where they kind of take advantage of people's journalistic impulses.
Robinson Meyer, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
It's Robinson Meyer. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He recently wrote about an MIT report on the spread of false news on Twitter. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. More on the idea of fake news, what it means, and what kind of impact it might have had in the 2016 presidential election. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. New research from MIT shows that false information is 70% more likely to get retweeted than accurate news. These findings resonate as federal investigations into Russian meddling in U.S. elections continue, and as Facebook and Cambridge Analytica are under fire for handling of user data. Clearly, so-called fake news is a part of daily life, but still unclear as whether that misinformation affected the 2016 election. We're talking about fake news, the political ramifications, and how to stop it. Joining us by phone is the director of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute, Alexios Mentzalis I'm sorry. Did I get that right, Alexios?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mansoor Elise. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Ohio State political scientist Richard Gunther. Welcome back, Dick.
Thank you very much.
Professor Gunther, you recently wrapped up a study of the impact false news had on the 2016 election in the United States. It's part of a much broader look at this impact around the world in elections. But how did you even go about this?
This is part of our Comparative National Elections Project, and we were going to be doing a survey of the American presidential election campaign anyway. But we incorporated a couple of fake news items into the questionnaire. And as a result, we're able to measure the impact of exposure to and belief in fake news on the vote. This is, again, part of this very broad project. We've done 50 national election surveys around the world in 27 countries. This fits into a very, very large comparative study of the effect of fake news, among other things, on the vote in a number of Western countries.
I suppose, Alexios, we ought to have a quick conversation before we get going about what we all agree we're talking about when we reference fake news. Alexios, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and there's been a lot of discussion about whether to abandon the term altogether. I think the concern among some is that it's being weaponized to obviously define any media that people disagree with. I think there's value in the term if we use it as it was originally being used by sort of practitioners two and a half years ago when it first really emerged as a big problem, and that sort of clickbaity misinformation that rides the social media algorithms to prominence for financial purposes and is provably false.
Do you agree, Dick Gunther, in that it's consciously done? It's done on purpose.
Yes. And the items that we're going to be analyzing are clearly false, but have been very, very broadly discussed in the media and were disseminated very widely through social media. The three items that we had in our questionnaire that directly address this are: Hillary Clinton is in very poor health due to a serious illness. Pope Francis endorsed Donald Trump for president prior to the election. And during her time as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton approved weapons sales to Islamic jihadists, including ISIS. So these have been fact-checked and found to be absolutely false, but they were very widely disseminated. And those are the ones whose impact we're going to be examining.
And you found that those story or that led you to believe, or how did that take you to the conclusion that fake news in 2016 probably had a big impact?
Well, that requires a great deal of work because just looking at the data per se can be misleading. And I'll tell you about that in 1 minute. What we did is focus our attention on people who had voted for President Obama in 2012. This is a sizable chunk of the 1,600 respondents in our survey. It was 585 people, in fact, who voted for President Obama. And we found that just 77% of them voted for Hillary Clinton. And that means 23% of the Obama base defected somehow. 10% went to cast ballots for Donald Trump, 4% to minor parties, and 8% did not vote. So our analytical problem was, how do we explain those defections? What was it that led people to abandon the Democratic ticket 4 years later and simply support other candidates or not vote? And we first examined the simple, straightforward correlation between exposure to and belief in fake news and abandoning Hillary Clinton in 2016. And the results at first glance are really quite startling. Among those who believed none of those three items, 89% voted in favor of Hillary Clinton. Among those who believed one of the false news items, it was down to 61%, but among those who believed two or three of the fake news items, it fell to 17%. Let me repeat that. The number of former Obama voters who cast ballots for Hillary Clinton fell to 17% among those who believed two or three of these false news items. Now, we can't take that at face value. That is certainly an interesting indicator, but one could argue that people are more prone to believe false news if they are Republicans, if they are conservatives, if they are ideologically on the right. And therefore, we had to control for a whole series of other variables to see if something else was explaining why those individuals defected. So we did that.
You went to the defectors from the Democrat side.
That's correct. We were focusing all of our attention on the defectors. And let's put this in perspective. If Hillary Clinton had retained the support of all of those voters, she would have been elected president.
Right. It was that narrow. We know that.
An absolutely critical set of voters whose behavior really contributed directly to the defeat of the Democratic ticket. And so we put that into an equation in which we controlled for gender, race, age, education, liberal versus conservative orientation, dissatisfaction with the economy, and party identification. And all of those together explained 38% of the variance in the vote, that is 38% of the defections. We then added to the equation our three fake news items, and that explained an additional 11% of the defections. That is a very sizable amount. And that's after we've controlled for that huge array of potential explanatory variables. We then pushed the envelope even further by including in the equation attitudes towards Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. One might argue that you're more prone to believe fake news if you don't like Hillary Clinton to begin with.
So if you already don't like her, that she's in poor health is more believable.
That is correct. Okay. So we included that into the equation in the next step. And this is, again, without fake news. And then we added as the final step the fake news. And we found fake news did, in fact, continue to have a very substantial impact on defecting from Hillary Clinton in 2016. And we found that those who were exposed to and believed fake news were four times more likely to defect after you control for everything else that we just mentioned than those who did not believe these fake news items. So we conclude that this is strong evidence that exposure to and belief in fake news had a very significant impact on the vote. Now, what we can't do at this stage is determine if that was enough to swing the election to Donald Trump. For that, we'd have to have a much larger sample. We'd have to be able to analyze the vote in individual states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan. Where the election really was determined. But when you consider that it was determined by only 77,000 votes in those three states, what you'd have to conclude is that even if the impact of fake news were relatively modest, the fact that we've been able to demonstrate that it is significant and it is independent of other factors, the way we've controlled for them in these equations, you would certainly conclude that it was likely something that contributed to the outcome of the election very significantly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from OSU political scientist Richard Gunther about a new study. You heard what he said. The fake news did affect the 2016 election, at least in terms of Democrat voters who defected from the Democratic side to vote for either Republican or independent or somebody else. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alexios, when you listen to this, are you surprised from where you sit, as director of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute?
No, although I would like to, pose the question to Professor Gunther.
Sure.
Because I think it's, first of all, the premise is I am so grateful to the increasing amount of academics that are turning to this topic and actually doing research, because we need this type of work in order to make a more effective strategies for fact-checking. So this is my premise. I have, I guess, two questions more than challenges. The first is to what extent we might be seeing sort of expressive responses from the sample. That is, you know, they say they believe something because they are already sort of on one side or the other. Uh-huh. And the reason I asked that is exclusively because I wondered whether the study actually tracked people's exposure to the websites that shared the fake news versus the false claims. And I guess the second question is, you know, with two of the three stories that were analyzed, I'm thinking of Hillary Clinton's health, uh-huh. and I'm thinking of her possibly, you know, shadowy ties to jihadists and weapon sales. Mm-hmm. Those are also stories that were relayed quite heavily in mainstream media and outside sort of the remit of just fake news, strictly defined. And so I'm wondering how, if in any way, the research controlled for the potential of these voters to have seen or have been mm-hmm. sort of subjected to these claims through more traditional media.
Right, because the videos of Hillary Clinton stumbling during that campaign event and that kind of a thing were, you know, which did occur, but had nothing to do with some kind of long-term health issue, you know, was reported a lot. Dick Gunther?
Yes, and we can certainly address the first of those questions. We do, in fact, have a substantial number of items in our questionnaire concerning exposure to political news through social media. And one of the additional steps that I took that I didn't describe is that we reran all of that analysis that I just described after removing from the pool of voters those who said that they did not use social media as a means of collecting political information. When we did that, the relationship between exposure to fake news and defection from Hillary Clinton increased. So initially, we could argue after you control for all of those other variables that I described, it would explain 4% of the variance by the time you remove those who were not exposed to social media political information. It was increased to 4.5 times more likely. Now, one of the things we cannot do, certainly, is separate out whether this is the impact of seeing something on television or reading something in social media. There's no way that we can determine that on the basis of a national survey, especially a single wave survey as ours was. Mm-hmm. But certainly with regard to trying to weed out those who could not have received this information through social media, we did take that step, and it actually confirmed and strengthened the analysis that I just described for you.
Alexios, how does this kind of research help you in strategies for fact-checking?
Yeah, I mean, we're constantly trying to glean lessons. I have to say that it takes, I guess, a broad set of studies to confirm something before mm-hmm. we can feel confident to move in one way. We know there are sort of more deeply ingrained psychological phenomena, such as, you know, the familiarity effect, which suggests that the more people hear something, the more they believe it to be true. Obviously, the confirmation bias and motivated reasoning. And so we're trying, especially at the network level, so with fact-checking partners of my organization, to see whether headlines can change in such a way that can sort of reduce the frequency of a myth being shared, mm-hmm. or even whether there are ways to avoid, we'll likely be conducting A/B testing to see whether adverse partisans, so people less likely to want to agree with something that's being fact-checked, are more likely to be reached if you remove, for instance, the name of the person being fact-checked. So would that have a greater likelihood of reaching folks who may otherwise sort of put up their partisan defenses and not even bother reading the content?
Okay, so how would you do that? I mean, what do you mean by removing the name of the person being fact-checked?
Right, so for instance, if we have a claim by President Trump that, you know, the unemployment level is, at a certain point, he said 42%. If the title of the fact check or the tweet spreading out the correction is, President Trump is wrong on unemployment figures, we suspect that there's going to be lower uptake or lower click-through from Trump supporters than if the tweet or headline says something like, the real unemployment figures are 5%. So asserting the truth rather than sort of flagging immediately whom you are correcting and what their false claim was might be a way forward. Again, this is just something that we'll be testing both on sites, in newsletters, and through Facebook.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about fake news. We're talking about the research now that is coming out about fake news, how fast it travels. We heard earlier from The Atlantic about a report by MIT that looked at the rate, the speed of travel that fake news has compared to real news. And now we're talking about how that can impact or whether it impacted some voters that were studied in a larger study with Richard Gunther. He's a political scientist at Ohio State. Also with us by phone, Alexios Mantzarlis. He is director of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about fake news, the political ramifications, and how to stop it. Still with us by phone is the director of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute, Alexios Mantzarlis. Also with us, OSU political scientist Richard Gunther. He recently wrapped up a study of the impact false news had on the 2016 election. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What, Alexios, what is your sense? It sounds like you're in a fast-growing business at this point. It's not decreasing as we become more aware of it. It's increasing. Am I right?
You're saying the quantity of misinformation or the sort of amount of fact-checking work being done?
The quantity of misinformation that you have to fact-check.
Yeah, for sure, it is not. It has not seemingly decreased. And the time and occasion where we see this most frequently is during breaking news instances. So, unfortunately, it has become a very familiar playbook. Any time that something horrible happens, whether in the United States or around the world, we see that among the first to respond on social media are hoaxers and, I guess, fake news impresarios. And so, They're even, you know, really lazy and just repurposed former hoaxes using photos of people who aren't victims or who aren't perpetrators and are able to sort of ride again this sort of increased attention to prominence and bring traffic to their websites. This hasn't gone away, and this does need to be a sort of a problem that we address systemically.
Katie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was wondering if the if people who share something that they know is fake just to kind of ridicule it, does that contribute to that getting shared again by people who might believe it?
Alexios?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely contributes to its capacity to be seen on other news feeds. So the way, and I'm talking specifically Facebook, obviously, the way the algorithm works is the more something gets reacted to, shared, commented, the more the algorithm understands that it's something that people want to see. So yeah, there isn't really a way to share something to denounce it without if you link to it without doing it some a favor.
Katie, thanks a lot for that call. We have an email from Rob. He says Hillary lost because she was a poor candidate running on the lackluster economic legacy of Barack Obama. Was there some fake news? Perhaps. But to say that fake news is the reason she lost is a stretch. The voters did not trust her or like her and her message. If you want to blame anyone for her loss besides her, blame Obama and the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, for forcing the party to nominate her. Now, first of all, Rob says, was there some fake news? Perhaps. No, Rob, there was fake news, just to clarify. But Richard Gunther?
Yes, we certainly agree with the analysis that people voted against Hillary because they didn't like Hillary, because they were dissatisfied with the condition of the economy or whatever. But we have controlled for that in this analysis. Once again, we did an equation that predicted the vote that did not take into consideration fake news, but did include dissatisfaction with the condition of the economy, dislike of Hillary Clinton, the liking of Donald Trump, party identification, separating Democrats, Republicans, and independents, separating conservatives from liberals, those with low education and those with higher education, race and gender. Those were all taken into consideration. And after that, we still have a significant impact of fake news.
Enough to turn the election.
That's what we can't say.
Okay.
Because in order to say that, we would have to have a sample that is large enough to make statements specific to the outcome of the vote in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, which is really where we're focusing our attention, since that was a very, very narrow margin of victory and determined the outcome of the election. But we certainly can say that there was a significant impact of exposure to and belief in fake news on the vote.
Yeah, Alexios?
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
Eager to jump in because I think that there's a route to, like, I understand the Rob's frustration in the sense that I think a lot of media coverage of studies and of analysis of the effect of fake news trivializes what these studies say and often runs on a very simple, you know, Trump won because fake news, which I think makes it harder for us to convey these sort of very scrupulous and rigorous studies of the style that Professor Gunther did in a way that then can be accepted and believed by all. So I think there's a bit of, I understand why it's not maybe a reaction to this show as much as a reaction to some of the headlines that the Rob might
that
have
it's
seen.
Taking away from a legitimate win.
Right.
Yeah. Dennis in Zanesville, you're on the air. Hi, Dennis.
What's up?
Not much. What's up with you?
Well, I was just going to make the point, fake news is an old story. When John Kennedy ran for president in 1960, he harped on the missile gap we had of the United States and Russia, except there really wasn't one. Now, that's not what helped him win that one issue, but it certainly was something which played into the panoply of ideas people consider. The idea of fake news in political parties and elections has been around forever. When I was in college, my professor I had in history said it was a common thing in the 1800s in presidential elections. Mm-hmm. You say a different thing in a different part of the country.
Right, but you could. I mean, so what's the difference? What's the distinction here, Richard Gunther, then? What's the difference?
A major difference is that in the past, when we had only broadcasting of news,
three networks.
That's
maximum,
correct.
Maximum, yeah.
And major newspapers. Mm-hmm. There was vetting. There was fact-checking that was often incorporated into the reports at some point during the election cycle. Nowadays, when you have individual messages specifically targeting subgroups of voters on the basis of their political beliefs, their religion, their preferences in music and food, as we've been following with Cambridge Analytics scandal, now you have an entirely different kind of personal impact. It's not just setting forth an argument out there. It's one that has a particular impact on an individual's preferences, personality, and partisanship that is specifically targeted. And that, I think, is very different. And that's something that emerged from technology that didn't exist more than 10 years ago.
Dennis, thanks a lot for that call. Lori in New Albany, you're on the air. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. My question is, what can we do with this information
to explain to voters and people that it's fake news, because regardless, it seems that my experience on social media is that nobody will believe it's fake news.
Alexios, lessons here?
Yeah, and it's an excellent question and a very proactive one. So thanks, Laurie. I think there are a couple of things. I think, first of all, there is study, at least on Twitter, that shows that friends are more capable of changing people's wrong perceptions than strangers. So even though it can be awkward, even though you may not want to, actually where you are most effective is with your network and with your friends. So plug away. One thing is obviously the tone and approach matters. As the cognitive scientist Dan Kahan at Yale says, oftentimes when we challenge someone on facts, they hear a challenge on who they are, on their identity, rather than on what they know. And so decoupling these two things is very important. Saying, you know, this fact is not accurate, but I'm not accusing you as a whole of being immoral, wrong, or a bad person. And then I think that in general, I do talk within the public a lot, and I find that I always ask the room how many people know, for instance, how to reverse search an image, which is one of the most simple tools. It's often just a right click away on some browsers. How to reverse search an image?
Search an image. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. And it's one of the simplest tools to see whether a photo has been misused, because if you find it used previously in other occasions, you can be pretty sure it's not from a breaking news situation. And I'm always a little disappointed at how many hands go up. I think there is a bit of a duty from all of us now, as not just media consumers, but small media disseminators and publishers through our social media accounts, to do a little better and to be the first small step in a more fact-checked online information environment.
Right. And Laurie, thanks a lot for that call. Richard Gunther, just in general, I mean, the role of the individual is heightened in all of this.
It certainly is. And one of the things that, again, makes social media so powerful as a distorting fact on this electoral process is that one of the things we found in our Comparative National Elections Project around the world is that the biggest influence on changing people's vote is intervention by people that you know. Simple exposure to factual material, receiving campaign leaflets, receiving a robocall or even a telephone call from a live person don't matter very much. But if you have a personal contact with someone, and especially if that's someone that you know and like, that is a powerful influence on the vote. And that's something that is really at the heart of social media, where you can convey your political preferences to a large number of individuals very, very easily. And again, that's something that is a new development that we have to come to grips with.
I'm just wondering, Alexios, and you too, Richard Gunther, whether or not, you know, as elections approach, you get calls from friends and family saying, okay, now tell me who I'm supposed to vote for. Alexios,
yes.
Do you get that?
I do not, but I do get to a point where, you know, we're having dinner and someone asks, is this true? As if it was some kind of encyclopedia. I don't know most of the time. I need to work too.
Right. But people are hungry for something they can rely on.
Yes, absolutely, and aware that it's a very messy noisy information environment. And this, and Professor Gunther might agree or disagree, I think is also part of the problem, right? That when people don't know what and how to trust, then it kind of turns them off all kinds of information, even the reliable stuff.
Right, yeah.
I would add to all of this that we've substituted replaced broadcasting with narrowcasting.
Uh-huh.
The way the media have developed, it began with sort of talk radio, right-wing talk radio at the beginning of the 1990s in particular. But then with the advent of Fox News and MSNBC, which really are partisan channels that reinforce political opinions quite powerfully. I think that's something that's very different in our media environment, as certainly as compared with what we saw in the 1970s and 1960s, where you had really neutral political figures like Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley. And now you have a much more partisan environment and a much more narrow channeling of news in a manner that reinforces individuals' prior political beliefs.
I just wanted to get to a quick, I think we had an email. Someone was asking whether or not, in an email, whether or not people, I guess it was in Facebook, whether or not people should ever, I mean, if we're ever going to get to a point where the skills that we're talking about, the discerning, these skills of discernment are going to ever be taught in school, like we used to learn how to type in school or our penmanship, if this is going to be something as fundamental as that. Richard Gunther?
That is being done in Italy. In terms of how does a government try to come to grips with the distorting impact of fake news in school curricula now in Italy, there are components dealing with fake news and trying to alert people to the fact that simply because they receive something through social media doesn't mean it's true and that they should be skeptical and use other sources of information to balance that.
And has it helped?
We don't know. They're okay. Just this beginning the program now.
Okay.
And I don't know if I don't know. The election data that are being collected as part of our project have not yet been passed to us. So we haven't had a chance to look at that yet.
Yeah.
But that will be interesting to see.
Yeah. Alexios, do you see it? I guess here's the Facebook message from Quo. It says, will discerning fake news ever be taught in schools, i.e. starting in grade school, like learning to type and use a computer? It seems like discerning fake news is now an essential skill.
I think so, and I think it's the positive proactive side rather than the negative debunking side. We'll see more and more sort of critical search of the internet as a component of every course, right? How do you search for historical facts on the internet? How do you search for? I think for many years and for my generation, for millennials who had the internet but didn't, but whose professors, whose teachers didn't really. A lot of the time it was, hey, don't trust Wikipedia. That was pretty much the main lesson to be drawn about how to find information online. And that's a pretty rubbish way to teach interacting with online information, considering that at least Wikipedia lists sources in a way that so much other stuff doesn't. So we, as an organization, April 2nd is actually International Fact-Checking Day. And we are going to be publishing a lesson plan for high school students as well as for college students. We did this last year. It was translated into dozens of languages and had a potential reach of about 100,000 students in 50 countries. So we're definitely doing our part, but I think that's a crucial component of fixing this problem.
Richard Gunther, just about 30 seconds.
Yes. I think there has to be change in the media themselves, in particular social media. I think the Wild West idea that anything goes, anything can be posted, there will be no consequences of intentionally disseminating false news, I think that is a model that has got to be completely altered. And I think the Wikipedia example is a very good one, where you started out with something that was rather shaky, but as time has gone on, there are self-policing mechanisms that really have created this as a useful source of information.
Well, Richard Gunther, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Richard Gunther, political scientist at Ohio State, and Alexios Mantzarlis, thank you as well. I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot. Have a wonderful day.
Alexios Mantzarlis is the director of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.